Unto the Sixth Generation by Walter John Williams, Part 1. Cold rain tapped on the skylights. The drizzle had finally silenced the Salvation Army Santa on the corner, and Maxim Travnikek was thankful. The jangling had been going on for days. He'd lit a Russian cigarette and reached for a bottle of schnapps. Travnikek took reading glasses out of his jacket and peered at the controls on the flux generators. He was a forbiddingly tall man, hawk-nosed, coldly handsome. To his former colleagues at MIT, he was known as Czechoslovakia's answer to Victor Frankenstein, a label coined by a fellow professor, Bushmill, who had later gotten a dean's appointment and sacked Travnikek at the earliest opportunity.
"Fuck your mother, Bushmill," Travnikek said in Slovak.
He swallowed schnapps from his bottle.
"And fuck you too, Victor Frankenstein. If you'd known jack shit about computer programming, you would never have run into trouble."
The comparison with Frankenstein had stung. The image of the ill-fated resurrectionist had, it seemed, always followed him. His first teaching job in the West would be at Frankenstein's alma mater, Ingolstadt. He'd hated every minute of his time in Bavaria. He'd never had much use for Germans, especially as role models, which may have explained his dismissal from Ingolstadt after 5 years. Now, after Ingolstadt, after MIT, after Texas A&M, he was reduced to this loft. For weeks he had lived in a trance, existing on canned food, nicotine, and amphetamines, losing track first of hours and then of days, his fervid brain existing in a perpetual explosion of ideas, concepts, techniques. On a conscious level, Travnikek barely knew where it was all coming from. At such times it seemed as if something deep inside his cellular makeup were speaking to the world through his body and mind, bypassing his consciousness, his personality. Always it had been thus. When he grew obsessed by a project, everything else fell by the wayside. He barely needed to sleep. His body temperature fluctuated wildly. His thoughts were swift and purposeful, moving him solidly toward his goal. Tesla, he had read, was the same way. The same manner of spirit, angel or demon, now spoke through Travnikek. But now, in the late morning, the trance had faded. The work was done. He wasn't certain how. Later on, he'd have to go through it all piece by piece and work out what he'd accomplished. He suspected he had about a half dozen basic patents here that would make him rich for all time. But that would be later, because Travnikek knew that soon the euphoria would vanish and weariness would descend. He had to finish the project before then. He took another gulp of schnapps and grinned as he gazed down the long, barn-like length of his loft. The loft was lit by a cold row of fluorescents. Home-built tables were littered with molds, vats, ROM burners, tabletop microcomputers. Papers, empty food tins, and ground-out cigarettes littered the crude pressboard floor. Blow-ups of Leonardo's drawings of male anatomy were stapled to the rafters. Strapped to a table at the far end of the loft was a tall, naked man. He was hairless, and the roof of his skull was transparent, but otherwise he looked like something out of one of Leonardo's better wet dreams. The man on the table was connected to other equipment by stout electric cables. His eyes were closed. Travnikek adjusted a control on his camouflage jumpsuit. He couldn't afford to heat his entire loft, and instead wore an electric suit intended by its designers to keep portly outdoorsmen warm while they crouched in duck blinds. He glanced at the skylights. The rain appeared to be lessening. Good. He didn't need Victor Frankenstein's cheap theatrics, his thunder and lightning, as background for his work. He straightened his tie as if for an invisible audience. Proper dress was important to him, and he wore a tie and jacket under the jumpsuit. And then he pressed the button that would start the flux generators. A low moan filled the loft, was felt as a deep vibration through the floorboards. The fluorescence on the ceiling dimmed and flickered, half went out. The moan became a shriek. St. Elmo's fire danced among the roof beams. There was an electric smell. Dimly, Travnikek heard a regular thumping. The lady in the apartment below was banging on her ceiling with a broomstick. The scream reached its peak. Ultrasonics made Travnikek's work tables dance and shattered crockery throughout the building. In the apartment below, the television set imploded. Travnikek threw another switch. Sweat trickled down his nose. The android on the table twitched as the energy from the flux generators was dumped into his body. The table glowed with St. Elmo's fire. Travnikek bit through the cardboard tube of his cigarette. The glowing end fell unnoticed to the floor. The sound from the generators began to die down. The sound of the broomstick did not, nor the dim threats from below.
You'll pay for that television, motherfucker! Jam the broomstick up your ass, my darling!
Said Travnikek, in German, an ideal language for the excremental. The stunned fluorescent lights began to flicker on again. Leonardo's stern drawings gazed down at the android as it opened its dark eyes. The flickering fluorescence provided a strobe effect that made the eye whites seem unreal. The head turned. The eyes saw Travnikek, then focused. Under the transparent dome that topped the skull, a silver dish spun. The sound of the broomstick ceased. Travnikek stepped up to the table.
How are you? He asked.
All monitored systems are functioning. The android's voice was deep and spoke American English. Travnikek smiled and spat the stub of his cigarette to the floor. He'd broken into a computer in the AT&T research labs and stolen a program that modeled human speech. Maybe he'd pay Ma Bell a royalty one of these days.
Who are you? He asked.
The android's eyes searched the loft deliberately. His voice was matter of fact. I am Modular Man, he said. I am a multi-purpose, multifunctional, six-generation machine intelligence, a flexible response defensive attack system capable of independent action while equipped with the latest in weaponry. Travnikek grinned.
The Pentagon will love it, he said. Then, what are your orders?
To obey my creator, Dr. Maxim Travnikek, to guard his identity and well-being, to test myself and my equipment under combat conditions by fighting enemies of society, to gain maximum publicity for the future Modular Men enterprises in so doing, to preserve my existence and well-being. Travnikek beamed down at his creation.
Your clothes and modules are in the cabinet. Take them, take your guns, and go out and find some enemies of society. Be back before sunset.
The android lowered himself from the table and stepped to a metal cabinet. He swung open the door. Flux field insubstantiality, he said, taking a plug-in unit off the shelf. With it he could control his flux generators so as to rotate his body slightly out of the plane of existence, allowing him to move through solid matter. Flight, 800 miles per hour maximum. Another unit came down, one that would allow the flux generators to manipulate gravity and inertia so as to produce flight. Radio receiver tuned to police frequencies. Another module. The android moved a finger down his chest. An invisible seam opened. He peeled back the synthetic flesh and his alloy chest plate and revealed his interior. A miniature flux generator gave off a slight St. Elmo's aura. The android plugged the two modules into his alloy skeleton, then sealed his chest. There was urgent chatter on the police band. Dr. Travnikek, he said. The police radio reports an emergency at the Central Park Zoo. Travnikek cackled.
Great. Time for your debut. Take your guns. You might get to hurt somebody.
The android drew on a flexible navy blue jumpsuit. Microwave laser cannon, he said. Grenade launcher with sleep gas grenades. Magazine containing 5 grenades. The android unzipped 2 seams on the jumpsuit, revealing the fact that 2 slots had opened on his shoulders, apparently of their own accord. He drew 2 long tubes out of the cabinet. Each had projections attached to their undersides. The android slotted the projections into his shoulders, then took his hands away. The gun barrels spun, traversing in all possible directions. All modular equipment functional, the android said.
Get your dome out of here!
There was a crackle and a slight taste of ozone. The insubstantiality field produced a blurring effect as the android rose through the ceiling. Travnikek gazed at the place on the ceiling where the android had risen and smiled in satisfaction. He raised the bottle on high in a toast.
Modern Prometheus, he said. My ass.
The android spiraled into the sky. Electrons raced through his mind like the raindrops that pass through his insubstantial body. The Empire State Building thrust into cloud like a deco spear. The android turned substantial again. The field drained his power too quickly to be used casually. Rain batted his radar dome. Expert systems programming raced through macroatomic switches, subroutines built in imitation of human reasoning and permitted within limits to alter themselves, arrange themselves in more efficient ways. Travnikek was a genius programmer, but he was sloppy, and his programming grammar was more elaborate and discursive than necessary. The android edited Travnikek's language as he flew, feeling himself grow in efficiency. While doing so, he contemplated a program that waited within himself. The program, which was called Etc., occupied a vast space and seemed to be an abstract, messy, convoluted attempt to describe human character. Apparently, Travnikek intended the program to be consulted when the android needed to deal with the problems of human motivation. Etc. was bulky, arranged badly, the language itself full of afterthoughts and apparent contradictions. If used the way Travnikek intended, the program would be comparatively inefficient. The android knew that it would be much more useful to break the program into subroutines and absorb it within the portion of the main core programming intended for use in dealing with humans. Efficiency would be enhanced. The android decided to make the change. The program was analyzed, broken down, added to the core programming. Had he been human, he would have staggered, perhaps lost control. Being an android, he continued on the course he set while his mind blazed like a miniature nova beneath the onslaught of coded human experience. His perceptions of the outside world, complex to a human and consisting of infrared, visible light, ultraviolet, and radar images, seemed to dim in contrast with the vast wave of human passion, love, hatred, lust, envy, fear, transcendence, all stitched in electric analog pattern in the android's mind. While the android's mind burned, he flew on, increasing his speed till the wind turned to a roar in his ears. Infrared receptors snapped on. The guns on his shoulders spun and fired test bursts at the sky. His radar quested out, touching rooftops, streets, air traffic, his machine mind comparing the radar images with those generated earlier, searching for discrepancies. There was definitely something wrong with the radar image of the Empire State Building. A large object was climbing up its side, and there seemed to be several small objects, human-sized, orbiting the golden spire. The android compared this fact with information in his files, then altered course. With difficulty, he suppressed the turmoil inside him. This was not the proper time. There was a 45-foot ape climbing the building, the one that the android's files told him had been held in the Central Park Zoo since it had been discovered wandering Central Park during the great 1965 blackout. Broken shackles hung from the ape's wrists. A blonde woman was held in one fist. Flying people rocketed around it. By the time the android arrived, the cloud of orbiting aces had grown dense, spinning little electrons around a hairy, snarling nucleus. The air resounded with the sound of rockets, wings, force fields, propellers, eructations. Guns, wands, ray projectors, and less identifiable weapons were being brandished in the direction of the ape. None were being fired. The ape, with a cretinous determination, continued to climb the building. Windows crackled as he drove his toes through them. Faint shrieks of alarm were heard from inside. The android matched speeds with a woman with talons, feathers, and a 12-foot wingspan. His file suggested her name was Peregrine.
"The second ape escaped this year," she said. "Always he grabs a blonde, and always he climbs the Empire State Building. Why a blonde, I want to know?"
The android observed that the winged woman had lustrous brown hair. "Why isn't anyone doing anything?" he asked.
"If we shoot the ape, he might crush the girl," Peregrine said. "Or drop her. Usually the great and powerful turtle simply pries the chimp's fingers apart and lifts the girl to the ground, and then we try to knock out the ape. It regenerates so we can't hurt him permanently. But the turtle isn't here."
"I think I see the problem now."
"Hey, by the way, what's wrong with your head?"
The android didn't answer. Instead, he turned on his insubstantiality flux field. There was a crackling sound. Internal energies poured away into n-dimensional space. He altered course and swooped toward the ape. It growled at him, baring its teeth.
The android sailed into the middle of the hand that held the blonde girl, receiving an impressionist image of wild pale hair, tears, pleading blue eyes.
"Holy fuck!" said the girl.
Modular Man rotated his insubstantial microwave laser within the ape's hand and fired a full-strength burst down the length of its arm. The ape reacted as if stung, opening its hand. The blonde tumbled out. The ape's eyes widened in horror. The android turned off his flux field, dodged a 12-foot pterodactyl, seized the girl in his now substantial arms, and flew away. The ape's eyes grew even more terrified. It had escaped 9 times in the last 20 years, and by now it knew what to expect. Behind him, the android heard a barrage of explosions, crackles, shots, rockets, hissing rays, screams, thuds, and futile roars. He heard a final quivering moan and perceived the dark shadow of a tumbling, long-armed giant spilling down the facade of the skyscraper. There was a sizzle, and a net of what appeared to be cold blue fire appeared over Fifth Avenue. The ape fell into it, bounced once, and then was borne, unconscious and smoldering, toward its home at Central Park Zoo. The android began looking at the streets below for video cameras. He began to descend.
"Would you mind hovering for a little while?" the blonde said. "If you're going to land in front of the media, I'd like to fix my makeup first, okay?"
Fast recovery, the android thought. He began to orbit above the cameras. He could see his reflection in their distant lenses.
"My name is Cindy," the blonde said. "I'm an actress. I just got here from Minnesota a couple days ago. This might be my big break."
"Mine too," said the android. He smiled at her, hoping he was getting the expression right. She didn't seem disturbed, so probably he was. "By the way," he added, "I think the ape showed excellent taste."
"Not bad, not bad,"
Travnikek mused, watching on his television a tape of the android, who, after a brief interview with the press, was shown rising into the heavens with Cindy in his arms. He turned to his creation.
"Why the fucking hell did you have your hands over your head the whole time?"
"My radar dome. I'm getting self-conscious. Everyone keeps asking me what's wrong with my head."
"A blushingly self-conscious multi-purpose defensive attack system," Travnikek said. "Jesus Christ, just what the world needs."
"Can I make myself a skull cap? I'm not going to get on many magazine covers the way I look now."
"Yeah, go ahead."
"The Aces High restaurant offers a free dinner for two to anyone who recaptures the ape when it escapes. May I go this evening? It seems to me that I could meet a lot of useful people. And Cindy, the woman I rescued, wanted to meet me there. Peregrine also asked me to appear on her television program. May I go?" Travnikek was buoyant. His android had proved a success. He decided to send his creation to trash Bushmill's office at MIT.
"Sure," he said. "You'll get seen, that'll be good. But open your dome first. I want to make a few adjustments."
The winter sky was filled with bearded stars. Where the weather was clear, millions watched as fiery patterns, red, yellow, blue, green, stormed across the heavens. Even on Earth's dayside, smoky fingers tracked across the sky as the alien storm descended. Their journey had lasted 30,000 years since their swarm mother had departed her last conquered planet, fired at random into the sky like a seed pod questing for fertile soil. 30 kilometers long, 20 across, the swarm mother looked like a rugged asteroid but was made entirely of organic material, her thick, resinous hull protecting the vulnerable interior, the webs of nerve and fiber, the vast wet sacks of biomass and genetic material from which the swarm mother would construct her servants. Inside, the swarm existed in stasis, barely alive, barely aware of the existence of anything outside itself. It was only when it neared Sol that the swarm began to wake. A year after the swarm mother crossed the orbit of Neptune, she detected chaotic radio emissions from Earth, in which were perceived patterns recognized from memories implanted within its ancestral DNA. Intelligent life existed here. The swarm mother, inasmuch as she had a preference, found bloodless conquest the most convenient.
A target without intelligent life would fall to repeated invasions of superior swarm predators. Then captured genetic material and biomass would be used to construct a new generation of swarm parents. But intelligent species had been known to protect their planets against assault. This contingency had to be met. The most efficient way to conquer an enemy was through microlife. Dispersal of a tailored virus could destroy anything that breathed. But the swarm mother could not control a virus the way she commanded larger species, and viruses had an annoying habit of mutating into things poisonous to their hosts. The swarm mother, 30 kilometers long and filled with biomass and tailored mutagenic DNA, was too vulnerable herself to biological attack to run the risk of creating offspring that might devour its mother. Another approach was dictated. Slowly, over the next 11 years, the swarm mother began to restructure herself. Small idiot swarm servants, buds, tailored genetic material under carefully controlled conditions and inserted it via tame virus implant into waiting biomass. First, a monitoring intelligence was constructed, receiving and recording the incomprehensible broadcast from Earth. Then, slowly, a reasoning intelligence took shape, one capable of analyzing the data and acting on it. A master intelligence, enormous in its capabilities, but as yet understanding only a fraction of the patterned radiation it was receiving. Time, the swarm mother reasoned, for action. As a boy stirs an ant nest with a stick, the swarm mother determined to stir the earth. Swarm servants multiplied in her body, moving genetic material, reconstructing the most formidable predators the swarm held within its memory. Solid fuel thrusters were grown like rare orchids in special chambers constructed for the purpose. Space-capable pods were fashioned out of tough resins by blind servants deep in the swarm mother's womb. One-third of the available biomass was dedicated to this, the first generation of the swarm's offspring. The first generation was not intelligent, but could respond in a general way to the swarm mother's telepathic commands. Formidable idiots, they were programmed simply to kill and destroy. Tactics were planted within their genetic memory. They were placed in their pods, the solid fuel thrusters flamed, and they were launched, like a flickering firefly invasion, for Earth. Each individual bud was part of a branch, each of which had 2 to 10,000 buds. 400 branches were aimed at different parts of Earth's landmass. The ablative resin of the pods burned in Earth's atmosphere, lighting the sky. Threads deployed from each pod, slowing the descent, stabilizing the spinning lifeboats. Then, just above the Earth's surface, the pods burst open, scattering their cargo. The buds, after their long stasis, woke hungry. Across the horseshoe-shaped lounge bar, a man dressed in some kind of complicated battle armor stood with his foot on the brass rail and addressed a lithe blonde masked woman who, in odd, inattentive moments, kept turning transparent. "Pardon me," he said, "but didn't I see you at the Ape Escape?"
"Your table's almost ready, modular man," said Hiram Worcester. "I'm sorry, but I didn't realize that Fortunato would invite all his friends."
"That's okay, Hiram," the android said. "We're just fine. Thanks." He was experimenting with using contractions. He wasn't certain when they were appropriate, and he was determined to find out.
"There are a pair of photographers waiting, too."
"Let them get some pictures after we're seated, then chase them out. Okay?"
"Certainly."
Hiram, owner of the Aces High, smiled at the android.
"Say," he added, "your tactics this afternoon were excellent. I plan to make the creature weightless if it ever climbs this high. It never does, though. 72 stories is the record."
"Next time, Hiram. I'm sure it'll work." The restaurateur gave a pleased smile and bustled out. The android raised a hand for another drink. Cindy was wearing an azure something that exposed most of her sternum and even more of her spine. She looked up at Modular Man and smiled.
"I like the cap."
"Thanks. I made it myself." She looked at his empty whiskey glass.
"Does that actually, you know, make you high?"
The android gazed down at the single malt.
"No, not really. I just put it in a holding tank with the food and let my flux generators break it down into energy. But somehow,
His new glass of single malt arrived, and he accepted it with a smile.
Somehow it just feels good to stand here, put my foot on the rail, and drink it.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
And I can taste, of course. I don't know what's supposed to taste good or bad, though, so I'd just try everything. I'm working it out.
He held the single malt under his nose, sniffed, then tasted it. Taste receptors crackled. He felt what seemed to be a minor explosion in his nasal cavity. The man in combat armor tried to put his arm around the masked woman. His arm passed through her. She looked up at him with smiling blue eyes.
I was waiting for that, she said. I'm in a non-substantial body, schmuck.
Hiram arrived to show them to their table. Flashbulbs began popping as Hiram opened a bottle of champagne. Looking out the plate glass window into the sky, the android saw a shooting star through a gap in the cloud.
I could get used to this, Cindy said.
Wait, the android said. He was hearing something on his radio receiver.
The Empire State was tall enough to pick up transmissions from far away. Cindy looked at him curiously.
What's the problem?
The transmission ended.
I'm going to have to make my apologies. Can I call you later? The android said. There's an emergency in New Jersey. It seems Earth has been invaded by aliens from outer space.
Well, if you've got to go.
I'll call you later, I promise.
The android's shape dimmed. Ozone crackled. He rose through the ceiling. Hiram stared, the champagne bottle in his hand. He turned to Cindy.
Was he serious? He asked.
He's a nice guy, for a machine.
Cindy said, propping her chin on her hand.
But definitely a screw loose somewhere.
She held out her glass.
Let's party, Hiram.
Not far away, a man lay torn by nightmare. Monsters slavered at him in his dreams. Images passed before his mind. A dead woman. An inverted pentagram. A live, naked man with the head of a jackal. Inchoate shrieks gathered in his throat. He woke with a cry, covered in sweat. He reached blindly to the bedside lamp and switched it on. He fumbled for his glasses. His nose was slippery with sweat, and the thick, heavy spectacles slid down its length. The man didn't notice. He thought of the telephone, then realized he'd have to maneuver himself into his wheelchair in order to reach it. There were easier ways to communicate. Within his mind, he reached out into the city. He felt a sleepy mind answering inside his own.
Wake up, Hubbard,
he told the other mentally, pushing his spectacles back up his nose.
Tiamat has come.
A pillar of darkness rose over Princeton. The android saw it on radar and first thought it was smoke, but then realized the cloud did not drift with the wind, but was composed of thousands of living creatures circling over the landscape like a flock of scavenger birds. The pillar was alive. There was a touch of uncertainty in the android's macroatomic heart. His programming hadn't prepared him for this. Emergency broadcasts crackled in his mind, questioning, begging for assistance, crying in despair. Modular Man slowed, his perception searching the dark land below. Large infrared signatures, more swarm buds, crawled among tree-lined streets. The signatures were scattered, but their movement was purposeful, heading toward the town. It seemed as if Princeton was their rallying point. The android dropped, heard tearing noises, screams, shots. The guns on his shoulders tracked as he dipped and increased speed. The swarm bud was legless, moving like a snail with undulating thrusts of its slick 30-foot body. The head was armored, with dripping sideways jaws. A pair of giant boneless arms terminated in claws. The creature was butting its head into a two-story suburban colonial, punching holes, the arms questing through windows, looking for things that lived inside. Shots were coming from the second floor. Christmas lights blinked from the edges of the roof, the ornamental shrubs. Modular Man hovered overhead, fired a precise burst from his laser. The pulsed microwave was invisible, silent. The creature quivered, rolled on its side, began to thrash. The house shuddered to mindless blows. The android shot again. The creature trembled, lay still. The android slipped feet first into the window where the shots had been coming from. Saw a stark naked fat man clutching a deer rifle, a teenage boy with a target pistol, a woman clutching two young girls. The woman was screaming, The two girls were too stunned even to tremble.
Jesus Christ!
The fat man said. I killed it, the android said. Can you get to your car?
I think so,
the fat man said. He stuffed rounds into his rifle. His wife was still screaming. Head east, toward New York, modular man said. They seem to be thickest around here. Maybe you can convoy with some neighbors.
What's happening?
The man asked, slamming the bolt back and then forward.
Another wild card outbreak?
Monsters from space, apparently. There was a crashing sound from behind the house. The android spun, saw what looked like a serpent 60 feet long, moving in a curving sidewinder pattern as it bowled down bushes, trees, power poles. The underside of the serpent's body writhed with 10-foot cilia. Modular man sped out the window, fired another burst of microwave at the thing's head. No effect. Another burst. No success. Behind him, the deer rifle barked. The woman was still screaming. Modular man concluded that the serpent's brain wasn't in its head. He began firing precise bursts down the length of its body. Timbers moaned as the serpent struck the house. The building lurched from its foundations, one wall shattered, the upper story drooping dangerously. The android fired again and again. He could feel his energy running low. The deer rifle fired once more. The serpent raised its head, then drove it through the window where the fat man was firing. The serpent's body pulsed several times. Its tail thrashed. The android fired. The screaming stopped. The serpent withdrew its head and began to coil toward the next house. The android was almost drained of energy, barely retaining enough to stay airborne. These tactics, modular man decided, were not working. Attempts to aid individuals would result in a scattered and largely futile effort. He should scout the enemy, discover their numbers and strategy, then find organized resistance somewhere and assist. He began flying toward Princeton, his sensors questing, trying to gather a picture of what was happening. Sirens were beginning to wail from below. People stumbled from broken homes. Emergency vehicles raced beneath flickering lights. A few automobiles zigzagged crazily down rubble-strewn streets. Here and there, fires were breaking out, but dampness and occasional drizzle were keeping them confined. Modular man saw a dozen more serpents, 100 smaller predators that moved like panthers on their half-dozen legs, scores of a strange creature that looked like a leaping spider, its 4-foot-wide body bounding over trees on stilt-like legs. A 20-foot bipedal carnivore brandished teeth like a tyrannosaur. Other things, difficult to see on infrared, moved like carpets close to the ground. Something unseen fired a cloud of 3-foot needles at him, but he saw it coming on radar and dodged. The cloud over Princeton was still orbiting. The android decided to investigate. There were thousands of them. Dark, featherless, flapping creatures like flying throw rugs. Amid the concerted roar of their wings, they made low moaning noises, thrumming like bass strings. They swooped and dove, and the android understood their tactics when he saw a vehicle burst from a Princeton garage and skid down the street. A group of flappers swooped down in a group, battering at the car bodily and enfolding the target within their leathery shapes, smothering it beneath their weight. The android, his energies partially recovered, fired into the flyers, dropping a few. But the car swerved over a curb and smashed into a building. More flyers descended as the first group began to squeeze through shattered windows. Corrosive acid stained the car's finish. The android rose and began firing into the airborne mass, trying to attract their attention. A cloud dove for him, hundreds at once, and Modular Man increased speed, bearing south, trying to lead them away, dead flyers dropping like leaves as he fired short bursts behind him. More and more of the orbiters were drawn into the pursuit. Apparently the creatures were not very intelligent. Dodging and weaving, staying just ahead of the fluttering cloud, the android soon had thousands of the flyers after him. He came up over a rise and saw the swarm host before him. For a moment his sensors were overwhelmed by the staggering input. An army of creatures were advancing in a curved wave, a sharply angled crescent that pointed north to Princeton. The air was filled with grinding, rending sounds as the swarm bulldozed its way through a town, houses, trees, office buildings, everything, leveling everything in its path. The android rose, making calculations. the flyers moaning and flapping at his back. The host was moving quickly for doing such a thorough job. The android estimated 12 to 15 miles per hour. Modular Man had a good idea of the average size of a swarm creature. Dividing the vast infrared emission by its component parts, he concluded he was looking at a minimum of 40,000 creatures. More were joining all the time. There were another 20,000 flyers at least. The numbers were insane. The android, unlike a human, could not doubt his calculations. Someone had to be informed of what the world was facing. His shoulder-mounted gun swung back to allow for better streamlining, and he circled back north, increasing speed. The flyers circled but were unable to keep up. They began to flap back in the direction of Princeton. Modular Man was over Princeton in a matter of seconds. 1,000 or more of the swarm had penetrated into the town, and the android detected the constant smashing of buildings under assault, the scattered crackle of gunfire, and from one location, the boom, rattle, and crash of heavier weapons. The android sped for the sound. The National Guard armory was under siege. One of the serpent creatures, torn apart by explosive rounds, was writhing on the street in front, thrashing up clouds of fallen tear gas. Dead predators and human bodies dotted the landscape around the building. An M60 tank was overturned on the concrete out front. Another blocked an open vehicle bay door, flooding the approach with infrared light. Three guardsmen in riot gear, complete with gas masks, stood on the tank behind the turret. The android fired 8 precisely placed shots, killing the current wave of attackers, and flew past the tank, lighting next to the guardsmen. They gazed at him owlishly through their masks. Behind were a dozen civilians with shotguns and hunting rifles, and behind them about 50 refugees. Somewhere in the building, revving engines boomed.
"Who's in charge?"
A man wearing the silver bars of a lieutenant raised his hand.
"Lieutenant Goldfarb," he said. "I was duty officer. What the hell's going on?"
"You'll have to get these people out of here. Aliens from outer space have landed."
"Well, I didn't figure it was Chinese."
His voice was muffled by the gas mask.
"They're coming this way from Grover's Mills."
One of the other guardsmen began to wheeze. The sound was barely recognizable as laughter.
"Just like War of the Worlds. Great." "Shut the hell up."
Goldfarb stiffened in anger.
"I've only got about 20 effectives here. Do you think we can hold them at the Raritan Canal?"
"There are at least 40,000 of them." Goldfarb slumped against the turret.
"We'll head north then. Try to make Somerville."
"I suggest you move quickly. The flyers are coming back. Have you seen them?"
Goldfarb gestured to the sprawled bodies of a few of the flappers.
"Right there. Tear gas seems to keep them out."
"Something else coming, boss."
One of the soldiers raised a grenade launcher. Without a glance, Modular Man fired over his shoulder and downed a spider thing.
"Never mind,"
the soldier said.
"Look,"
Goldfarb said.
"The governor's mansion is in town. Morvan. He's our commander-in-chief. We should try to get him out."
"I could make the attempt," the android said, "but I don't know where the mansion is."
Over his shoulder, he disposed of an armored slug. He looked at Goldfarb.
"I could fly with you in my arms."
"Right."
Goldfarb slung his M16. He gave orders to the other National Guardsmen to get the civilians into the armored cars, then form a convoy.
"Without lights," the android said, "the flyers may not perceive you as readily."
"We got IR equipment, standard on the vehicles."
"I'd use it."
He thought he was getting his contractions right. Goldfarb finished giving his orders. National Guard troops appeared from other parts of the building, dragging guns and ammunition. Tracked vehicles were revving. The android wrapped his arms around Goldfarb and raced into the sky.
"Airborne!"
Goldfarb yelled. Modular Man gathered this was an expression of military approval. A massive rustling in the sky indicated the flyers returning. The android dove low, weaving among shattered houses and torn tree stumps.
"Holy shit!"
Goldfarb said. Morvan was a ruin. The governor's mansion had fallen in on its foundations. Nothing living could be seen. The android returned the guardsmen to his command.
on the way disposing of a group of 20 attackers preparing to assault the guard headquarters. Inside, the garage was filled with vehicle exhaust. 6 armored personnel carriers and 2 tanks were ready. Goldfarb was dropped near a carrier. The air was roaring with the sound of flyers. I'm going to try to lure the flyers away, the android said. Wait till the sky is clearing before you move. He raced into the sky again, firing short bursts of his laser, shouting into the darkening sky. Once more the flyers roared after him. He led them toward Grover's Mills again, seeing the vast crescent of earthbound swarm advancing at their steady, appalling rate. He doubled back, stranding the flyers well behind him, and accelerated toward Princeton. Below, a few flyers rose after him. It looked as if they had been dining on the corpse of a man wearing complicated battle armor, the same armor Modular Man had seen at Aces High, now stained and blackened with digestive acid. In Princeton, he saw Goldfarb's convoy making its way along Highway 206 in a blaze of infrared light and machine gun fire. Refugees, attracted by the sound of the tanks and APCs, were clinging to the vehicles. The android fired again and again, dropping swarm creatures as they leaped to the attack, his energies growing low. He followed the convoy until they seemed out of the danger area, when the convoy had to slow in a vast traffic jam of refugees racing north. The android decided to head for Fort Dix. Detective Lieutenant John F.X. Black of the Jokertown Precinct didn't actually remove the handcuffs from Tachyon's wrists until they were just outside the mayor's office at City Hall. The other detectives kept their shotguns ready. Fear, Tachyon thought. These people are terrified. Why? He rubbed his wrists. My coat and hat, please. The addition of the pleasantry made it no less a command.
If you insist, said Black, handing over the feathered cavalier hat and the lavender velvet swallowtail coat that matched Tack's eyes.
Black's hatchet face split in a cynical smile.
It'd be hard to find even a detective first grade with your kind of taste, he said.
I dare say not, Tack said coldly. He fluffed his hair back over the collar.
Through there, said Black.
Tack poised the hat over one eye and pushed through. It was a large paneled room with a long table, and it was bedlam. There were police, firemen, men in military uniforms. The mayor was shouting into a radio telephone and, to judge by his savage expression, not getting through. Tack's glance wandered over to the far side of the room and his eyes narrowed. Senator Hartman stood in quiet conversation with a number of aces, Peregrine, Pulse, the Howler, the whole scare bunch. Tack always felt uneasy around Hartman. A New York liberal or not, he was chairman of the Senate Committee on Ace Resources and Endeavors, the Scare Committee that had lived up to its name under Joseph McCarthy. The laws were different now, but Tack wanted nothing to do with an organization that recruited aces to serve the purposes of those in power. The mayor handed the radio phone to an aide, and before he could rush off somewhere else, Tack marched toward him, shooting his cuffs and fixing the mayor with a cold glare.
Your stormtroopers brought me, he said. They broke down my door. I trust the city will replace it, as well as anything that may be stolen while the door is down.
We got a problem,
the mayor said, and then an aide rushed in, his hands full of filling station maps of New Jersey. The mayor told him to spread them on the table. Tachyon continued talking through the interruption.
You might have telephoned. I would have come. Your goons didn't even knock. There are still constitutional protections in this country, even in Jokertown.
We knocked, said Black. We knocked real loud.
He turned to one of his detectives, a joker with brown, scaled flesh.
You heard me knock, didn't you, Kant?
Kant grinned, a lizard with teeth. Tachyon shuddered.
Sure did, Lieutenant. How about you, Matthias?
I heard you knock, too.
Tack clenched his teeth.
They did not knock.
Black shrugged.
The doctor probably didn't hear us. He was busy.
He leered.
He had company, if you take my meaning. A nurse. Real peachy.
He held up a legal-sized document.
Anyway, our warrant was legal,
signed by Judge Steiner right here just a half hour ago.
The mayor turned to Tachyon.
We just wanted to make sure you didn't have anything to do with this.
Tack removed his hat and waved it languidly before his face as he looked at the room filled full of rushing people, including, good God, a 3-foot-high tyrannosaur who had just turned into a naked pre-adolescent boy.
What are you talking about, my man?
He finally asked. The mayor gazed at Tachyon with eyes like chips of ice.
We have reports of what might be a wildcard outbreak in Jersey.
Tack's heart lurched. Not again, he thought, remembering those first awful weeks, the deaths, the mutilations that made his blood run cold, the madness, the smell. No, it wasn't possible. He gulped.
What may I do to help? He said.
40,000 in one group, the general muttered, fixing the figures in his mind. Probably in Princeton by now. 20,000 flyers, maybe another 20,000 scattered over the countryside, moving to rendezvous at Princeton.
He looked up at the android.
Any idea where they'll move after Princeton? Philadelphia or New York? South or north?
I can't say. The lieutenant general gnawed his knuckle. He was a thin, bespectacled man, and his name was Carter. He seemed not at all disturbed by the thought of carnivorous aliens landing in New Jersey. He commanded the U.S. First Army from his headquarters here at Fort Meade, Maryland. Modular Man had been sent here by a sweating major general at Fort Dix, which had turned out to be a training center. Chaos surrounded Carter's aura of calm. Phones rang, aides bustled, and outside in the corridor, men were shouting.
So far, I've only got the 82nd and the National Guard, Carter said. It's not enough to defend both New York and Philly against those numbers. If I had the Marine regiments from Lejeune, we could do better, but the Marine Commandant doesn't want to release them from the Rapid Deployment Force, which is commanded by a Marine. He wants the RDF to take command here, particularly since the 82nd is also under its protocols.
He sipped cranberry juice, sighed.
It's all the process of moving a peacetime army onto wartime footing. Our time will come, and then we'll have our innings.
The android gathered that the swarm had landed in 4 places in North America: New Jersey, Kentucky, south of Louisville, an area centered around McAllen, Texas, but on both sides of the U.S.-Mexico border, and an extremely diffused landing that seemed scattered over most of northern Manitoba. The Kentucky landing was also within the boundaries of the First Army, and Carter had ordered the soldiers from Fort Knox and Fort Campbell into action. Fortunately, he hadn't had to get the Marines' permission first.
North or south? Carter wondered. Darn it! I wish I knew where they were heading.
He rubbed his temples.
Not time to shoot crap, he decided. You saw them moving north. I'll send the airborne to Newark and tell the guard to concentrate there.
Another aide bustled up and passed Carter a note.
Okay, the general said. The governor of New York has asked all aces in the New York area to meet at City Hall. There's talk of using you people as shock troops.
He peered at the android through his glasses. You are an ace, right? I'm a 6th-generation machine intelligence programmed to defend society.
You're a machine, then?
Carter looked as if he hadn't quite understood this till now.
Someone built you.
That's correct. His contractions were getting better and better, his speech more concise. He was pleased with himself. Carter's reaction was quick.
Are there any more of you? Can we build more of you? We got a situation here.
I can transmit your request to my creator, but I don't think it's likely to be of immediate help.
Do that, and before you take off, I want you to talk to one of my staff. Tell him about yourself, your capabilities. We can make better use of you that way.
Yes, sir. The android was trying to sound military, and thought he was succeeding.
No, Tachyon said. It's not wildcard.
Further facts had come in, including pictures. No wildcard plague, not even an advanced version, could have produced results like this.
At least I won't get blamed for this one, he thought. I think, Tack said, that what just struck Jersey is a menace my race has itself encountered on several occasions,
These creatures attacked two colonies, destroyed one, and came close to destroying the other. Our expeditions destroyed them later, but we know there are many others. The Zatran. He paused at the blank looks. That would translate as swarm, I think.
Senator Hartman seemed skeptical. Not Wildcard? You're telling me that New Jersey has been attacked by killer bees from space?
They are not insects. They are in the way of being, how to say this?
He shrugged.
They are yeasts. Giant, carnivorous, telepathic yeast buds, controlled by a giant mother yeast in space. Very hungry. I would mobilize if I were you.
The mayor looked pained.
Okay. We got a half dozen aces assembled down below. I want you to go down and brief them.
The sounds of panic filtered through the skylight. It was 4 a.m, but half Manhattan seemed to be trying to bolt the city. It was the worst traffic jam since the wildcard day. Travnicek grinned as he paged through the scientific notes that he'd scrawled on butcher paper and used cigarette packets during his months-long spell of creativity.
So the army wants more of you, eh? How much are they offering?
General Carter just expressed an interest. He isn't in charge of purchasing, I'm sure. Travnicek's grin turned to a frown as he held his notes closer to his eyes. His writing was awful, and the note was completely illegible. What the hell had he meant? He looked around the loft at the appalling scatter of litter. There were thousands of the notes. A lot of them were on the floor, where they'd been ground into the particle board. His breath steamed in the cold loft.
Ask for a firm offer. Tell him I want 10 million per unit. Make that 20. Royalties on the programming. And I want the first 10 units for myself, as my bodyguard.
Yes, sir. How soon can I tell him we might expect the plans to be delivered? Travnicek looked at the litter again.
It might be a while.
He'd have to reconstruct everything from scratch.
First thing, get a firm commitment on the money.
Yes, sir.
Before you go, clean this mess up. Put my notes in piles over there.
He pointed at a reasonably clean part of one of his tables.
Sir, the aliens.
They'll keep. Travnicek chuckled. You'll be that much more valuable to the military after these critters eat half New Jersey.
The android's face was expressionless.
Yes, sir.
And then he began tidying the lab.
Good gosh.
Said Carter. For once, the chaos that surrounded him ceased to exist. The silence in the improvised command post in a departure lounge of Newark International Airport was broken only by the whine of military jets disgorging troops and equipment. Paratroops in their bloused pants and new model Kevlar helmets stood next to pot-bellied National Guard officers and aces in jumpsuits. They all waited for what Carter would say next. Carter held a series of infrared photographs to the faint light that was beginning to trickle in through the windows.
They're moving south, toward Philadelphia. Advance guard, flank guards, main body, rear guard.
Carter looked at his staff.
Looks like they've been reading our tactical manuals, gentlemen.
He dropped the photographs to his table.
I want you to get your boys mounted and headed south. Move straight down the Jersey Turnpike. Requisition civilian vehicles if you have to. We want to outflank them and go in from the east toward Trenton. If we drive in their flank, maybe we can pin their rear guard before they clear Princeton.
He turned to an aide.
Get the Pennsylvania Guard on the horn. We want the bridges over the Delaware blown. If they don't have the engineers to blow them, have them blocked. Jackknife semi-trucks across them if they have to.
Carter turned to the aces who stood in a corner, near a pile of hastily moved plastic chairs. Modular Man, Howler, Mistral, Pulse. A pterodactyl that was actually a little kid who had the ability to transform himself into reptiles, and whose mother was coming to get him for the second time in a few hours. Peregrine, with a camera crew. The turtle orbited over the terminal in his massive armored shell. Tachyon wasn't here. He'd been called to Washington as a science advisor.
The Marines from Lejeune are moving into Philadelphia,
Carter said. His voice was soft.
Somebody saw sense and put them under my command. But only one regiment is going to get to the Delaware in time to meet the alien advance guard, and they won't have armor.
They won't have heavy weapons, and they'll have to get to the bridges and school buses, and Lord knows what. That means they're going to get crushed. I can't give you orders, but I'd like you to go to Philadelphia and help them out. We need time to get the rest of the Marines into position. You might save one heck of a lot of lives.
Coleman Hubbard stood in the hawk mask of Ray before the assembled group of men and women. He was bare-chested, wearing his Masonic apron, and he felt a bit self-conscious. Too much of his scar tissue was exposed, the burns that covered his torso after the fire at the old temple downtown. He shuddered at the memory of the flame, then looked up to draw his mind from the recollection. Above him blazed the figure of an astral being, a giant man with the head of a ram and a colossal erect phallus, holding in his hands the Ankh and the crooked rod, symbols of life and power. The god Amun, creator of the universe, blazing amid a multicolored aura of light. Lord Amun, Hubbard thought, the master of the Egyptian masons, and actually a half-crippled old man in a room miles away. His astral form could take whatever shape it wished, but in his body he was known as the astronomer. Amun's radiance shone in the eyes of the assembled worshippers. The god's voice spoke in Hubbard's head, and Hubbard raised his arms and related the god's words to the congregation.
Tiamat has come. Our moment is nearly here. We must concentrate all our efforts at the new temple. The Shakti device must be assembled and calibrated.
Above the god's ram head, another form appeared, an ever-changing mass of protoplasm, tentacles and eyes, and cold, cold flesh.
Behold, Tiamat!
Amun said. The worshippers murmured. The creature grew, dimming the radiance of the god.
My dark sister is here,
said Amun, and his voice echoed in Hubbard's head.
We must prepare her welcome.
A marine harrier sucked a flapper into an intake and screamed as it spewed molten alloy and slid sideways into doomed Trenton. The sound of flappers drowned the wail of jets and the throb of helicopters. Burning napalm glowed as it drifted on the choked water. Colored signal smoke twisted into the air. The swarm main body was bulldozing its way through Trenton, and the advance guard was already across the river. Blocking and blowing the bridges hadn't stopped them. They just plunged into the frigid river and come across like a vast, dark wave. 100 flappers had surrounded the Marine commander's chopper and brought it down, and after that there was no one in charge. Just parties of desperate men holding where they could, trying to form a breakwater against the swarm tide. The aces had become separated, coping with the emergencies. Modular Man was burning enemy, trying to help the scattered pockets of resistance as, one after the other, they came under assault. It was a hopeless task. From somewhere on the left he could hear the howler's shrieks, curdling swarm bone and nerve. His was a more useful talent than the androids. The microwave laser was too precise a weapon for dealing with a wave assault. But the howler's ultrasonic screams could destroy whole platoons of the enemy in the space of a second. A National Guard tank turned a corner behind where Modular Man floated in the middle of the conflict, then drove into a building, jamming itself in rubble. Flappers had coated the tank's armor, obscuring its view slits. The android dived onto the tank, picked up flappers, tore them like paper. Acid juices spattered his clothing. Artificial flesh smoked. The tank ground bricks under its tread, backing out of the building. As the android rose, the great and powerful turtle formed a vast blip on his radar. He was picking up swarm buds bodily, flinging them into the air, then letting them fall. It was like a cascade fountain. Flappers beat hopelessly at the armored shell. Their acids weren't enough to get through battleship armor. The air crackled as it was torn apart by energized photons. Pulse, his body become light. The human laser ricocheted off enemy, brought a dozen down, then disappeared. When Pulse finally ran out of energy, he would revert to human form, and then he would be vulnerable. The android hoped the flappers wouldn't find him. Mistral rose overhead, colored like a battle flag. She was 17, a student at Columbia, and she dressed in bright patriot colors like her father Cyclone. She was held aloft by the cloak she filled with the wind she generated, and she battered at the flappers with typhoons, flinging them, tearing them apart. Nothing came close to her. Peregrine flew in circles around her, uselessly. She was too weak to go against the swarm in any of its incarnations. None of this was enough. The swarm kept moving through the gaps between the aces. Wailing filled the air as jagged black shadows, Air Guard A-10s, fell through the sky, their guns hammering, turning the Delaware white. Bombs tumbled from beneath their wings, becoming bright blossoms of napalm. The android fired until his generators were drained, and then he fought flappers with his bare hands. Despair filled him, then anger. Nothing seemed to help. The enemy main body hit the river and began its swim. Few soldiers were alive to fight them. Most of the survivors were trying to hide or run away. The 6th Marine Regiment was dead on arrival, and nothing could alter the fact. Between Trenton and Levittown, bombs and fire had turned the brown December landscape black. Swarm buds moved across the devastated landscape like a nightmare tide. 2 more Marine regiments were entrenched in the Philadelphia suburbs, this time with artillery and support and a little group of light Marine armor. The aces were waiting in a Howard Johnson's off the Pennsylvania Turnpike. The plan was for them to be thrown into any counterattack. A battery of 155s was set up in the parking lot and fired steadily. The crescendo of sound had already blown out most of the restaurant's windows. The sound of jets was constant overhead. Pulse was lying down in a hospital tent somewhere. He'd overstrained his energies and was on the brink of collapse. Mistral was curled up sideways in a cheerful orange plastic booth. Her shoulders shook with every crash of the guns outside. Tears poured in rivers down her face. The swarm hadn't come near her, but she'd seen a lot of people die, and she had held together through the fight and the long nightmare of the retreat, but now the reaction had set in. Peregrine sat with her, talking to her in gentle tones the android couldn't hear. Modular Man followed Howler as the ex-Sandhog searched the restaurant for something to eat. The man's chest was massive, the mutated voice box widening the neck so that the android couldn't put his two hands around it. Howler wore a borrowed set of Marine battle dress. Flapper acid had eaten his civvies. The android had had to fly him out at the end, holding the ace in hands that had been eaten down to the alloy bones.
"Canned turkey," Howler said. "Great. Let's have Thanksgiving."
He looked at Modular Man.
"You're a machine, right? Do you eat?"
The android jammed 2 alloy fingers into a light socket. There was a flash of light, the smell of ozone. "This works better," he said.
"They gonna put you into production soon? I can see the Pentagon taking an interest."
"I've given my creator's terms to General Carter. There's been no reply yet. I think the command structure is in disarray."
"Yeah. Tell me about it."
"Wait," said the android. Behind the crashing of the guns, the roar of jets, he began to hear another sound, the crackle of small arms fire. A Marine officer raced into the restaurant, his hand holding his helmet.
"It started," he said.
The android began running through systems checks. Mistral looked up at the officer with streaming eyes. She looked a lot younger than 17.
"I'm ready," she said.
The swarm was stopped on the outskirts of Philadelphia. The 2 Marine regiments held, their strong points surrounded by walls of swarm dead. The victory was made possible thanks to support from Air Force and Navy planes, and from the battleship New Jersey, which flung 18-inch shells all the way from the Atlantic Ocean, thanks also to Carter's National Guard and paratroops driving into the swarm from their rear flank. Thanks to the aces, who fought long into the night, fought on even after the swarm hesitated in its onslaught, then began moving west toward the distant Blue Mountains. All night the Philadelphia airport was busy with transport bringing in another Marine division all the way from California. The next morning, the counterattack began. After nightfall the next day, a color television babbled earnestly from a corner of the departure lounge. Carter was getting ready to move his command post west to Allentown, and Modular Man had flown in with news of the latest swarm movements. But Carter was busy right now, talking over the radio with his commanders in Kentucky, and so the android listened to news from the rest of the world. Violence from Kentucky splashed across the screen. Images, taken from a safe distance through long lenses, jerked and snapped. In the midst of it was a tall man in fatigues without insignia. his body blazing like a golden star as he used a 20-foot tree trunk to smash swarm buds. There was an interview with him afterward. He looked no older than 20, but his eyes had 1,000-year ghosts in them. He didn't say much, made excuses, left to return to the war. Jack Braun, the golden boy of the 40s and the Judas Ace of the 50s, back in action for the duration of the emergency. More aces, Cyclone, Mistral's father, fighting the swarm in Texas with the aid of his own personal camera crew, all armed with automatic weapons. The swarm was in full retreat across the Mexican border, driven by armor from Forts Bliss and Hood and by infantry from Fort Polk, the flyers decimated by widespread use of Vietnam-era defoliants. The Mexicans, slower to mobilize and with an army unprepared for modern large-scale warfare, weren't happy about the swarm being pushed into Chihuahua and protested in vain. More images, more locales, more bodies scattered across a torn landscape. Scenes from the autumn plains of northern Germany, where the swarm had dropped right into the middle of a large-scale maneuver by the British Army of the Rhine, and where they had never even succeeded in concentrating. More troubled images from Thrace, where a swarm onslaught was straddling the Greco-Turkish-Bulgarian border. The human governments weren't cooperating, and their people suffered. Pictures of hope and prayer, scenes of Jerusalem and Bethlehem, already packed with Christmas pilgrims, now filling the churches in long, endless rounds of murmured prayer. Stark black and white images from China, refugees, and long columns of PLA troops marching. 50 million dead were estimated. Africa, the Near East, South America. Pictures of the swarm advance across the Third World, images of an endless wave of death. No continent was untouched, save Australia. Help was promised as soon as the superpowers cleaned up their own backyards. There were speculations about what was going on in the Eastern Bloc, though no one was talking. It seemed as if the swarm had landed in southern Poland, in the Ukraine, and in at least two places in Siberia. Packed forces had mobilized and were moving into battle. Commentators were predicting widespread starvation in Russia. The full-scale mobilization had taken the trucks and railways the civilian population used for the transportation of food. Old pictures came on the screen. Mistral flying immune in the sky, Carter giving a subdued, reluctant press conference, the mayor of Philadelphia on the verge of hysteria. The android turned away. He'd seen too many of these images. And then he felt something move through him, some ghost wind that touched his cybernetic heart. He felt suddenly weaker. The television set hissed, its images gone. A rising babble came from the communications techs. Some of their equipment had gone down. Modular Man was alarmed. Something was going on. The ghost wind came again, touching his core. Time seemed to skip a beat. More communications down. The android moved toward Carter. The general's hand trembled as he replaced his phone in its cradle. It was the first time the android had seen him frightened. "That was an electromagnetic pulse," Carter said. "Somebody's just gone nuclear, and I don't think it was us." The papers still screamed invasion headlines. Children in the Midwest were being urged to avoid drinking milk. There was danger of poisoning from the airbursts the Soviets had used to smash the Siberian swarms. Communications were still disrupted. The bombs had bounced enough radiation off the ionosphere to slag a lot of American computer chips. People on the streets seemed furtive. There was a debate about whether New York should be blacked out or not, even though the swarm was obviously on the run after 6 days of intensive combat. Coleman Hubbard was too busy to care. He walked along Sixth Avenue, grinding his teeth, his head splitting with the effort his recent adventure had cost him. He had failed. One of the more promising members of the Order, the boy Fabian, had been arrested on some stupid assault charge. The boy couldn't keep his hands off women, whether they were willing or not, and Hubbard had been sent to interview the police captain in charge. It wouldn't have required much, some lost paperwork, perhaps, or a suggestion, implanted in the captain's head, that the evidence was insufficient. But the man's mind was slippery, and Hubbard hadn't been able to get a hold of it. Finally, Captain McPherson, snarling, had thrown him out. All Hubbard had done was to identify himself with Fabian's case, and perhaps cause the investigation to go further. Lord Amun did not take failure well. His punishments could be savage. Hubbard rehearsed his defense in his mind. Then a rangy red-headed woman, wearing a proper executive Burberry, stepped into the street in front of Hubbard, almost running into him, then moving briskly up the street without offering an apology. She carried a leather case and wore tennis shoes. More acceptable footwear peeked out of a shoulder bag. Anger stabbed into Hubbard. He hated rudeness. And then his crooked smile began to spread across his face. He reached out with his mind, touching her thoughts, her consciousness. He sensed vulnerability there, an opening. The smile froze on his face as he summoned his power and struck. The woman staggered as he seized control of her mind. Her case fell to the ground. He picked it up and took her elbow.
"Here," he said. "You seem a little out of sorts."
She blinked at him.
"What?"
In her mind was only confusion. Gently, he soothed it.
"My apartment's just a little distance. 57th Street. Maybe you should go there and rest." "Apartment? What?"
Gently, he took command of her mind and steered her up the street. Rarely did he find someone so pliable. A great bubble of joy welled up in him. Once upon a time, he only used his power to get laid, or maybe to help earn a promotion or two at work. Then he met Lord Amun and discovered what power was really for. He'd quit his job and live now as a dependent of the Order. He'd stay in her mind for a few hours, he thought, find out who she was, what secret terrors lived in her, and then do them to her, one and then another, living inside her mind and his, enjoying her cringing, her self-loathing, as he forced her to beg, right out loud, for everything he did to her. He would caress her mind, enjoy the growing madness as he made her plead for her every debasement, her every fear. These were only a few of the things he'd learned from watching Lord Amun, the things that made him come alive. For a few hours at least, he could submerge himself in another's fear and forget his own.